the Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and joining me tonight, the father to my mother and the canon to my father, it's Brian. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Scott. That was pretty good.
I thought so. That might be the high point of the podcast. Yes, we are here tonight. We are kicking off our coverage of the long-awaited and subsequently delayed season 4 of Fargo. Now, Brian, I know it's been said we've been apart for several weeks. You know, when last we spoke, I was about to say Perry Mason, but I forgot. We did Doom Patrol after Perry Mason was over, or did we do that in between? I don't even remember now.
I think we did Doom Patrol either right after or right towards the end of Perry Mason. I don't remember which, but you know, it's been, I think, at least 4 or 5 weeks since we've been together.
It's definitely, yeah, the Doom Patrol kicking off the first of several multi-hour podcasts, which we've done here. But fortunately, there shouldn't be any more full season or double season coverage for the rest of the year. Oh, wait, I might do one about The Crown that covers multiple seasons later in the year. Oh, wait, okay, that should be like a 17-hour podcast. So hopefully our friend David watches The Crown, because he'll be the one person to appreciate it. But tonight, again, we are here to talk about Fargo. And as luck would have it, just as I mentioned, length of podcast, we got a double dip to start things off. We got two episodes, both of them being extra long, which, as we know from previous seasons of Fargo and also Noah Hawley's work on Legion, that's not unusual for him to run a little long. I don't know if it's a Noah Hawley thing. Maybe it's an FX thing, because other shows on FX have also been guilty of that. But certainly Noah Hawley shows are known for that, I think. So, but like I said, Noah Hawley actually wrote and directed both episodes, so don't need to run through the credits beyond that. The first episode was titled Welcome to the Alternate Economy. And I'll tell you right now, the second episode was titled The Land of Talking and Killing. Because once you get back-to-back episodes that are both written and directed by the same person, and they're, especially when they're introducing us to, you know, storylines and characters, it really is like, you know, one big season premiere. They don't feel like two separate entities to me, at least as far as I could tell with these two episodes.
No, the first two episodes really sort of moved everybody into position and set the, I guess you'd say, the inciting action into motion, and we're ready to kick off episode 3, you know, in the middle of the action. So I thought, when you told me how long it was, I was surprised, but it didn't feel that long, and it was enjoyable.
Right. Oh, no, absolutely. I was actually surprised by how well things were humming along. Not that Hawley's work tends to drag, but again, it was one of those things when you hear ahead of time, okay, you're going to be sitting there for 2 hours and nearly 45 minutes worth of product. Now, granted, some of that time was taken up by scenes from later this season, scenes from the next episode, and why they choose to run several commercials for the show you're watching while you're watching the show always confuses me. I'm already watching Fargo. You don't need to keep showing me ads for Fargo. I'm already here watching it. But even if you hack all that stuff out, it is still, you know, like 2.5 hours, two hours and 20 minutes, whatever. We got a lot of stuff. And like you said, it is, you know, setting things in motion. And the hard part when you're dealing with an anthology series such as this is, you know, every season starts off, you got to introduce a... I was going to curse. I'm trying not to curse, but I think I know I'm going to curse at some point on the podcast. A whole lot of characters. And I can already tell you right now, I mean, I watched the two episodes back to back. They even gave us a moment where they literally named all the characters on screen. So one could have easily just paused it and written down all these character names. And as usual, because it's Noah Hawley, some of these character names are simply amazing. They're just wonderful unto themselves. You know, either you have a character named Banjo Rightway or Dr. Senator, or what was that one? Constant Calamita, I think, was one character's name. And it's just like, okay, there we go. Some things never change. Some characters we haven't even heard the name of yet, but I already had looked them up. And it's like, oh, that guy's name is, his last name is Weff, Weff. Great. I don't think anyone in the history of the earth has ever been named that. Watch, we'll get a comment that someone is. But it's just, there's a lot to do in when you're dealing with the beginnings of a season of Fargo. And especially in a season like this, where you're dealing with, multiple mob family/organizations. And so you're going to run into the problem. And I can already tell it's going to be a bit of an issue for the season. Not unusual. I've seen this with other shows as well and movies as well. You're going to confuse people with each other. And hopefully at least what Hawley has done with other shows, and Fargo seasons, actually, he's done a pretty nice job of delineating the differences between characters so that you really don't confuse them. But when you're dealing with something which is really playing into the whole, especially the Italians, when you're dealing with the whole, this is the, early era of the mafia kind of concept, Schwartzman aside, because he's going to stand out in any room, I think, you're going to run into the confusion issue. So hopefully they do a decent job in future episodes of really making it clear who each person is, other than, wait, it's all skinny guy, and that's the old guy, and that's the heavy guy from back from the boot and stuff like that.
Yeah, I thought there was a concerted effort to make that delineation, so much so that there were a couple of jokes, in sort of the dark satire of Hawley and the Coen brothers theme, that the stuffy administrator was Dr. Harvard and, on the nose. And at one point, even in one of the scenes, someone's referred to as someone's cousin, and they don't even give him a name at that point. So I think there was a nod and a wink. And yes, if anyone's interested, at midnight, which is probably now, Alan Sepinwall was going to post a screenshot of the scene where everyone's name was put on screen.
Oh, really?
I just checked it at the end of watching. I saw on Twitter he was going to put that up, but I thought it was really neat. And they almost did police blotter playing cards for several of the characters to sort of signify the importance of some of them compared to others. So, he introduced us to a very large world of characters.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll see over the course of the next several episodes just how important a part each of these characters actually plays. Some characters we got introduced to and they didn't really do much, but we can pretty much assume, but they'll probably be busy later on. Even the ad for the next episode pretty much, tells us that. I was like, oh, her aunt and her friend are going to start robbing stuff by next episode. Cool. And yes, I did like the little, what do you call it? As you said, the police blotter intro kind of thing, kind of reminded me a little bit of when you'd be introduced to a different convict on Oz. They would give you a quick little, inmate, whatever their inmate number was and their name and what they did. And we might see a little bit of it. This is one of those things, if you felt like pausing the screen, you would read, what crimes they might have done. The fact that, if you were watching, the part I really loved about the entire 2+ hours was the opening 15 minutes, where we get the 50-year history of the underworld in Kansas City. And when they give us a little, police blotter card on the head of the Irish mob, one of the crimes he had been taken in for was actually buggery. And went, oh, okay, all right. So, just to somewhat quickly paint the picture of the setting for the story that's going to be unfolding, throughout the season, although the show is called Fargo, it's not taking place in the oft-mentioned but rarely used titular locale. The show never takes place in Fargo, North Dakota. But this time we're also not in any part of Minnesota either. That's a bit of a switch. This time we're totally in Kansas City, Missouri, which, unless I'm mistaken, was referenced and briefly seen. I guess it was back in the second season of Fargo, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, the one that was in the early 80s, I think, or late 70s. I know Ronald Reagan was campaigning, whatever. So, like I said, we get a little history of the organized crime in that region. So, you know, I just love how they kind of whip through how there were, you know, the ones were powerful Jewish gangsters who eventually lost their power to the Irish, and the Italians came in and wiped them out. And then we're picking up a story here in 1950, which is certainly a few decades earlier than any previous Fargo season. And now with the Italians in control, but now an up-and-coming black crime syndicate, you know, an organization formed over the years, apparently by men who had fled from like the Jim Crow South to make a better life for themselves, you know, even if it is the world of crime. So those are the main factions we're dealing with. And the Italians are led by the Fada family. And I'm just going to keep pronouncing it that way because I can't help it. Because the moment I heard the name, I was like, my first thought was like, hello, Mada, hello, Fada. With Donatello as essentially the Don and his son, Josto, who is played by, of course, Jason Schwartzman. It's just ridiculous watching him in any role, but I enjoy it. And the Black Crime Organization is, of course, led by Loy Cannon, and that's Chris Rock. So we get to see Chris Rock in a solid, serious performance. Although I love the fact that the very first word we hear him say is nah, which sounded very much like Chris Rock. It just sounded like the way he might as well be stalking on a stage with a microphone the way he said nah.
Yeah, I liked it. And I like that he didn't undergo a transformation of his voice. I mean, it is Chris Rock in a different kind of role. But yeah, and that sort of starts with comedy, but then it turns serious very quickly.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I was almost surprised that they didn't go for the obvious, which they actually do later in the episode with other characters. But they didn't do it with Chris Rock's character. Because initially when he does the thing with the, you know, cutting the palm and, you know, let's be men, whatever. And Donatello turns to his men, you know, like, you know, this boy thinks he's a man. He says it in Italian. I was expecting Chris Rock's character to actually know what he said and make it and kind of say something on the spot to kind of prove the point. But that didn't happen. We do get to see that happen with other characters and other situations later on. So maybe Noah Hawley figured I can't go to that well more, you know, too many times. It'll be too goofy on the show. And one of the major conceits of what was going on with the underworld throughout these decades was potentially warring mob families would essentially trade a son to be raised by the other family. There's some way to be like shockingly noble for the times and learn about, you know, supposedly to learn about the other family's ancestry and culture, which probably never really worked out, but it was more of a way to keep the peace. So each family would have a trump card on the other family's son. And also, as we saw when we get that little history lesson, hasn't worked out so well. Even though there is one remaining guy who has kid who is actually, he's no longer a kid, but he's kind of been through this. So you have that. That's where you end up with the character whose name is Rabbi Milligan, who's played by Ben Whishaw, I think his name is. His name is Milligan, and I know he's white, but it's 1950, and we already have seen one. We already have one multiracial family thing going on here. Do you think there's any chance he could be a early ancestor of Mike Milligan, who we saw in season 2 of Fargo?
Absolutely.
Has to be, right? Kansas City, yep. Whatever. You don't pick that name otherwise, I think. So I'm kind of curious to see, you know, where we'll go with that character. It's going to be one of those things where if by season's end, if he ends up at some point with a a woman of color, shall we say, I'm going to be like, that's right, he's his dad.
So. Yeah, we do have a Minnesota connection through Orietta Mayflower.
Yes.
So, you know, they throw in an obligatory don't you know to let you know she's firmly from where Fargo will end up years later. But,
absolutely.
You know, very, very large group of characters. I'm surprised we've remembered as many names as we have. I think as it goes on, like you say, I think there's a conscious effort I see in affecting all these characters with just slightly different traits to make them memorable, like the OCD or Tourette's cop. I don't know which he possesses, the dirty cop that works for the Fadas.
The guy who played by Jack Houston. So
it's
like Boardwalk Empire, dude.
Yeah.
So, with a normal face. I'm pretty much looking at him as an OCD guy, because it's the knocking on the door thing. That's just that's pure OCD. At least that's where they're riffing on it, I guess. And Arietta Mayflower is our nice little connection to the Minnesota accents we have gotten so used to over from the movies through all the season of Fargo. I love her introduction to her. She's what I would call unintentionally offensive.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Clinically racist.
Yes. And just sticking with her for a moment, because it's interesting, because when I think about what we've watched over the last couple hours, is that a dog?
Yeah, that's the dog. He decided to be a spectator. Sorry.
That's okay. Hey, Jamie's dog appeared on the last podcast. And we know how many times dude has done his meowing work, and he probably will again tonight, if I'm not mistaken. I gave him a little dish of milk to shut him up, but that'll probably work for 15 minutes. Anyway, what I thought was interesting is most of the characters that we were introduced to were either part of those two main factions I spoke of, or directly connected to them in some way. You know, like the detective, when we find out he's actually someone who's on the Fada's payroll or someone like that. I mean, I'm not really giving much credence to like minor characters who I don't think will play, I don't figure playing much of a part, like, you know, the various hospital administrators, even though obviously one they do, we probably will see again because they want to do something about him. But you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But Arietta kind of sticks out. It's almost, she's kind of, I don't know what the word is. I was going to say cipher, but that's totally not the correct word for it. But she does stick out in all this, because you have, you know, between the mob crime stuff, and you also have the family that we're also following, who was also giving us a bit of narration initially, it was the Smutney family. And the voice that we're guided through a lot of this is Ethelrida Pearl Smutney, the daughter, and who comes from a biracial family, and they're also run the local mortuary there. But Arietta, really, she's doing the whole angel mercy of death kind of thing. So basically, she's kind of a cross between Nurse Ratched and Annie Wilkes, essentially. Yeah, in one character.
Totally.
I kept thinking, is Noah Hawley just riffing on Stephen King now? Because it kind of feels like it a little bit here. And it's funny, because we fast forward with her character when she actually, I guess, let's just say, kills the Don. And then at the moment it was happening, I was like, wait a minute, did she think that's what Josto meant when he said take care of him? Because I'm pretty sure that's not what he was talking about. I'm almost positive of that. And then as it played out, obviously it wasn't what he wanted. But I am astonished about how she gets what she gets away with the hospital administrator when they basically bust her late in the second episode.
Yeah, I thought that she read him correctly, because I thought he was upset about the conversation in the car, which, you know, was another one of the humors that initially I thought the Don had a heart attack, and a lot of times or you know, as they the joke on Community, a fart attack. But I did think that he wanted his dad to go, because his dad wasn't listening to him in the car. But, you know, in a stroke of divine providence, he found the one person. We find out, like, this isn't her first time. Like, he happened to just by chance get the perfect person to do this because she has a history of this.
I would agree that perhaps to a large extent, this was an outcome he would have preferred because of what you were just saying. But I don't think that, I don't think he would have gone to a total stranger nurse and asked that. So I don't think that, so I don't think when he said it here, that's what he meant. Not judge based on his reactions and everything else and how they're going after the other, the hospital administrator and everything else. That's, at least that's not how I'm interpreting it so far. Because he does, because there's been no acknowledgement of her. And I'm waiting, you know, you're waiting for the ring thing to come up. Because
oh, yeah.
Because you heard the person who I guess is probably his mother, I'm assuming, referencing the ring. And I'm like going, oh, okay. And I keep thinking that'll be when he actually figures it out. Because he to me, clearly, he doesn't know that's what happened. That's the way I'm interpreting it so far. Also, keep in mind, At least no one with white skin so far on the show is all that bright. Although Arietta's not too dumb. Because how the hell did she get out of that? I can't believe someone who's literally been killing patients, and they seem to kind of sort of know it, and she's able to talk them out of, you know, she's able to talk herself into getting severance and a recommendation. That's crazy.
It is, and I think where she had them was that this had happened before and they didn't report it and do anything about it. Right. And, you know, at some point it's on you too, if you're the supervisor administrator and you knew she was doing it and you were still letting her do it and you didn't do anything or report it. So, you know, but you see her quickly shift. You know, you kind of wonder if she's just sort of loopy and bird brained and, but she shifts, and you see she is maniacally gifted at manipulation.
Absolutely, but I think she's clearly insane as well.
Oh, yeah, totally.
I mean, okay, we can, I don't want to say understand, but even someone with whatever mental conditions she might have, but we get the whole nurse killing patients who are elderly when she thinks that they'd be better off. It's a, hence, you know, mercy killing, whatever, even if it's wrong, especially if they're not, you know, terminally ill, about to die kind of thing. And she takes it to a murderous extreme. That'll, I hate to say it, it's insane, but it makes sense. The pie she makes and brings over to across the street to the Smutby family. Am I pronouncing it correctly? Hope I am. Anyway, the mortuary family I was talking about. And she puts in the Epicac syrup, which is, if I'm not mistaken, if I remember my old cartoons, that's the stuff you take that makes you throw up.
Yep.
Why is she doing that?
I don't know. And when she gets off the bus, she's talking to herself crossing the street. And obviously, isn't just talking to herself out loud, is actually having a conversation with herself, which is quite disturbing.
Put a hidden camera in my house any day, see a lot worse. I mean, obviously she's had these conversations with the young girl who, has kind of been one to both correct her and also show that, you know, hey, guess what? You may think you're smart, but I'm probably just as smart as you, if not smarter. And regardless of Arietta's condescending tone, you're like, oh, I didn't know they were teaching French in the, you know, in the Negro schools and all that kind of stuff. No, I learned it on my own. So I think there's a certain, maybe she's kind of intimidated, and therefore she kind of wants to, you know, take her down a couple pegs, at least in her warped mind. I mean, why do that otherwise? It's just, plus, they're going to know you. Plus, what's totally crazy about it, they're going to know you did it. That's what's kind of insane about it. You're not going to get away with this if they actually eat the pie. I mean, granted, what happens at the end of the of the second episode, I'm going to guess that no one ever gets around to having the pie, you know? But it's, she's doing these things much like the killing of the patients, and she doesn't see the potential consequences of it. So it's
right. Right. Now, I think the for me, the introduction of the family and the mortuary story is where I'm most curious how that plays into everything. Mm-hmm. And we do get, you know, there's been a run of shows that we've covered and talked about that obviously were filmed a long time ago, that all are sort of converging on the issue of what it means to be a lower class, what it means to be a different or oppressed minority. Mm-hmm. And I thought one of the most compelling things that comes out in the show pretty quickly is that, you know, at different times in our nation's history, a lot of people who walk around and don't suffer what they used to were also in the position of being looked down upon and had to fight and claw for everything that they wanted to get. And in many ways, the immigrants and the black people had more in common than the white people trying to keep them down. And I thought that was an interesting reflection throughout the episodes.
Yeah, absolutely. It is an interesting coincidence that it seems like we've had a series of shows now doing this. You know, if you want to say it starts with Watchmen and then it moves into this year between we got a little bit on Perry Mason, of course. You got Lovecraft Country that's going on right now. You've got this series. I know I've skipped a few others that have happened throughout the year. I'll forget it. You all know what shows I'm talking about. Obviously, it's great because we're getting not just different perspectives, but it's also covering different eras and different parts of the country and how people, how situations that might have been in Kansas City and Missouri might not be the same as, you know, somewhere in Mississippi or somewhere in New York City or whatever. And the fact that you have, like in this, you have men who are very much in control up to a certain point. They possess a certain gravitas and authority. Granted, even though they are involved in the world of crime, but of course, one of the great Noah Hawley conceits in this that we see is one of their plans is one of those way ahead of its time ideas, which is the actual credit card. Which I thought was hysterical, and touches like that also remind me of all the little nods they're making to, as they do on every season of Fargo. They always need to be nods and references to any number of Coen Brothers movies, and we certainly got a few in this. And the whole situation with the credit card, even the banker's office with the. What do you call it? The pneumatic tubes and whatever. My mind went straight to Hudsucker Proxy.
Yeah, that's what I thought too.
And Hudsucker Proxy going as far as when they had the idea of like the hula hoop, and kind of like, oh, the credit it's like the hula hoop idea, which a character suddenly comes up with on that. Here, a character's coming up with a credit card. The other thing you can't get away from throughout this, as far as the Coen Brothers thing is like, it's Miller's Crossing. It's Miller. I mean, it's mobsters with really cool hats, from left to right. And sometimes the hats do more of the acting than the people. It's very Miller's Crossing. So, which I appreciate because, that's one of those overlooked, really fantastic Coen Brothers movies that people don't seem to talk about enough nowadays.
Yeah, it's a fantastic movie. And, the way everybody looked, it is curious to see a cast of characters where everybody is, just excellently dressed and, everyone looks great. The cars, the buses, everything looks wonderful. And it really takes you there. Even the crossing guard, in the scene where you have the cap guns, the BB gun, setting the time and I was pleased the show didn't go in the way that, and it may, but it didn't immediately go to all out war because the Don got shot with a pellet. Mm-hmm. No one heard a shot. Right. And you do hear, you know, I don't know how you pronounce it, Jason Schwartzman's character. Is it Gusto? Not.
I'm calling him Josto until I hear otherwise.
Okay, Josto.
That's how I pronounce it.
You do hear him say, I think it was the kids. You haven't seen him try. You didn't see him immediately move to say it was the black guys that did this.
Right.
I thought it had an interesting precipitating act that didn't go in the way I thought. And right now there's an uneasy truce with an investigation, I guess, pending to determine the fate of the slaughterhouse.
Right. Even though it was interesting with the slaughterhouse, because I felt that was what Josto had said earlier in the episode, that this was the deal that their father made. I thought they were referring to that specifically, but maybe they were just referring to the overall deal with them as far as the trading the kids and the uneasy alliance, etc. Maybe that's what he was referring to. I thought he was talking about the slaughterhouse specifically, but that could have been a mistake on my part. He might have just been talking in general, because otherwise, then Gaetano clearly knows that they've already gotten the okay for this, and he does what he does anyway. And this is gonna build to something else, you know, by the next day. I don't know. So I probably misunderstood that.
Well, I mean, I can see it your way too, having heard you say it. But that brings in Gaetano, who, interestingly enough, killed fascists or killed communists for a fascist until fascism was bad for business. And so we hear talk of the war, and we see, another common thing we've seen throughout Fargo, that, that a family is only strong when it's not at each other's throat. And we, I don't think it's any surprise Gaetano is going to be a problem.
Well, yeah, right. Absolutely. And also, as far as classic Fargo things, again, going along with the way I read what happened in the first episode specifically, isn't there always at least one major just mistake made, an error, an error in judgment, a goof, whatever, something that leads to something horrible, which then has a domino effect on everything else. That's a tradition born out of the original movie, of course. But if I'm not mistaken, if you think about every season of Fargo, usually the major thing goes wrong was because someone goofed, it was an accident, someone made a mistake. Whether it be, Kirsten Dunst hitting, basically hitting the guy with her car, which clearly was an accident. And what she chose to do from that point on, clearly a lapse in judgment.
Very clear.
Or things that happened in season one, as far as, what Freeman says to Thornton's character, that, wait, this isn't exactly what I had in mind. I mean, it's a tradition that goes all the way back to, like, Strangers on a Train,
right.
when Guy and Bruno are talking on the train, and Bruno, and Guy's not taking him seriously. It's like, sure, it's a great idea. Not realizing, hey, guess what you just set in motion. So with this, it's Arrieta killing the Don, because now that he's out of the picture, now you're more likely to have, we're already seeing it happen, the family start to squabble with each other. I mean, even in that final montage at the end, it's no coincidence we see, each family getting to get having their meal, whatever, and Gaetano tries to take the head of the table seat.
Right.
And he does get up for him, but he can tell, it's like, there's a number of things in the episode. It's like, I don't think he thinks he's not respecting his brother in the position that he's in. And he clearly clearly thinks that he should probably move in and be in charge. So I'm assuming that's kind of where we're going to be going with that conflict there.
Right. No, I totally agree. And, I love the rapid introduction of a lot of stuff that still gave good coloring. Like we find out quickly, that Josto has a fiance, of an alderman who he's trying to help, win election And that's obviously a marriage of convenience for both of them to gain power. So we learn all these little things. I'm curious what you think the significance, of the past. There's the surviving member, the surviving child, of the Jewish family, and the way the kids are treated. You know, Chris Rock, I mean, makes the comment, his character Loy does, you know, how does it feel to sleep in the master's house to him?
Right.
I thought that was pretty interesting that they didn't just keep it simple, that there was this other character that somehow is tied up in this complicated history.
Well, he's basically, I thought of him being like a 1950s version of, it's been a while. You're going to have to, what's the name of the character from Game of Thrones? The one who eventually becomes Reek for a while there.
Oh, Theon Greyjoy?
Theon Greyjoy. This guy's Theon Greyjoy.
I think that's fair.
Because think about it, because the whole thing is like, basically they took him on after they, you know, after conquering the families that he was originally from, and he ended up becoming part of them. You know, he was always going to be different, but he's still part of them. And I think that's the story with this guy. He's part of them, but he's still different. He's still, you know, he's not Italian. But he's clearly held in some regard. He's there at the meet. He's holding a gun on them just like everybody else is. Except he's been entrusted with the kids, so maybe he's not looked at the same way. But based on the way he speaks and the way he acts, you know, he might be I could be wrong. We have to wait to see if there's future episodes where he has any scenes of this nature. But maybe he could be almost, I don't want to go as far as to give him like a Tom Hagen consigliere kind of a thing, but I could see that to a certain extent, because he seems to be, from the limited conversations we've heard, he certainly seems to be a bit wiser than anyone else we've run into, at least on that side of the fence. So I'm wondering if he'll play a more significant part other than being the one entrusted with the care of the other family's kid, which, you know, I don't know if it's irony, but him having been that kid a couple of times himself, it's, I guess, eerily appropriate if he's the one taking care of the kid.
Right, right. I do like, too, that the what's the name of the speakeasy that's at the center of everything at the beginning? Is it Golson's or
Joplin's?
Joplin's, yeah, Joplin, yeah. Missouri.
We thought of our friend Jamie, who lives in Joplin, Missouri. So every time I kept seeing Joplin's on screen, I kept thinking, "Oh, she must be loving this, or maybe not."
Yeah, well, I like the way they, you know, everything happens there. Everything is so basically showing you history just keeps repeating.
Oh yes, absolutely, absolutely. And I know we've already spoken enough about the traffic stop scene, but I just wanted just to tie a button on it by saying it's a great scene to have that much tension built up as we're, you know, which it keeps escalating, and then it ends with a loud, long fart. So
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You don't, and then the heart attack, of course.
So, right.
Just like going, oh, you son of a bitch.
Yeah.
Well, we've actually covered a lot of stuff already. One thing we didn't it was funny when the beginning of the second episode, when we see those two, and initially I think they're two teenage girls, but I guess they're a bit older than that once I got to see them, you know, cleaning themselves up in the bathroom or something. Again, the black girl and the white girl, it looks like presumably they've escaped from maybe a women's prison or something. And we learn that one of them is actually Ethelreda's aunt, and the other one, he is our Legion connection, or one of a couple, because I think there may be more than one in this season. The character is her name, because I don't think they named her on the show, but her name is actually Swanee Capps.
They said it one time.
I thought they said Swanee, but I don't know if they gave her a last name.
They didn't. They just said her first name.
Swanee Capps. Come on. But speaking of great names, I mean, even the actress herself has a great name. It's Amber Midthunder from Legion. So that image almost unrecognizable until you tell them, like, oh, look at that. You know, there's no Bill Irwin anywhere near her. It's very strange.
Our beloved Carrie.
Yes. So I am just zipping to see if there's anything that was really, I mean, the things that really kind of caught my attention, especially as we got through the second episode, is, you know, the Gaetano showing up is definitely a source of menace here. I mean, he reminds me of a number of characters that could have walked in right off of Boardwalk Empire or something like that. But at the same time, it's funny how I already mentioned a couple Coen Brothers things. The other thing throughout these two and a half hours, whatever, and specifically I'm referring more to the mob stuff, although I guess I could twist around to Orietta's nursing stuff too. It's one of those things where you start trying to decide, okay, are we just playing homage to any number of mob movie things here? Or are we just giving in to cliches from mob movies here? Or are you just lifting and not, because there was a number of things that just like, oh, that's reminiscent of this and that's reminiscent of that. You know, whether it be a Don dying, with kids around, or even though, or this in this case, due to kids. Or just a bunch of things that just I kept going, okay, that's a little godfathery there. All right, look at that.
There was a scene, it may have been when they were walking in the bank, that I swore that was the staircase from Untouchables.
Oh, well, I'm assuming it was. Especially because this, as I was told recently on Facebook, this was shot in Chicago.
Huh.
So I was wrong. This was not shot in Canada. What now I'm watching it. Now I know that I mentioned that on an earlier podcast. My mistake was I was looking at the filming locations that they gave just for the, in general, which I think was specific to the first season. But when you go to that season and this episode specifically, you'll discover, no, it's shot in Chicago. And which I think is also really funny because it's taking place in Kansas City, Missouri. But if you were to randomly, if someone said to you, okay, we're going to be shooting a mob movie in America. What's the first city you think of when you think the mob? It's Chicago. It's not New York. It's Chicago. That's classic. That's classic mob stuff. So all I know is if I see a baby carriage shot to go down those stairs at some point, it's like, don't you battleship Potemkin me, mother. Anyway.
I mean, I thought there were great homages throughout, but it really is setting up an interesting story, and the where my attention's directed now is to the mortuary, and there's no doubt what's going to happen between the families, and the question is how do you get your kids out? That adds a pretty dynamic emotional component that each family has a kid with the other family. So whatever happens has, potentially dire consequences. But then you have this other family that's, black and white. And we do see, and they don't tell us anything, we do see Loy and his folks at the mortuary. Now, I guess we can assume he borrowed from them, but it doesn't say that. And maybe there's a connection to the wife, to Loy and his family, and maybe they're in hock to the Italians. We don't know.
My impression was, again, it's just the way I interpret things, but they do leave things somewhat open to interpretation because that way you could be wrong. My assumption was that they were in debt. The mortuary family, or how do I spell their names? Is it Smutby? I know because the first syllable being the word smut sounds Smutney, Smutny. There we go. The Smutney family, the King of Tears mortuary, if I'm not mistaken. That's what I think it's what it said outside.
Yeah.
My impression was that the folks that they were in debt to, as far as a loan, was the actual the Canon Unlimited. I didn't think it was the Italians, but that may just be an assumption on my part. It's because they were the men that were there, and that's why I'm naturally thought. Plus, being a multiracial family, probably be easier for them to get money from the black syndicate than perhaps the Italians. I'm not sure. I'm making an assumption. I don't know. I am very curious about it because there's a whole bunch of things going on there. Because we got those two women who just escaped from prison, presumably, and now they're holed up there. And as we see at the end, we see, well, hey, look, it's, you know, we get 2 seconds of Timothy Oliphant, you know, leading the charge of several troopers and marshals and who knows what, as he, you know, kicks down a door. So pretty much looks like Timothy Oliphant's once again playing a lawman wearing a cowboy hat. something he's kind of, I think now we can call it typecasting, you know, because if you got your Justified, you got your Deadwood, and you got this character, and I'm betting there's a couple others I can't even think of unless I had his IMDb page open in front of me. Like, yeah, we're typecasting. I'm kind of curious if he's going to goof on those a little bit, if we're going to see him kind of making fun of himself as far as the characters he's played in both Justified and Deadwood. So that's kind of one of the reasons I'm kind of excited to see him on the show. But obviously, we need to pick up the episode. You know, I'm assuming the next episode will pick up right there, at least moments later. I don't. But then again, it's Noah Hawley. Who the heck knows what he's going to do? Interesting though. So each of the previous 3 seasons, I've just been thinking about this, usually deals with an ordinary person, ordinary citizen, ordinary fan, whatever, that somehow gets wrapped up in something crime-related to a certain extent. Criminals also play a major part as well. So whether it be, you know, Martin Freeman's character being the regular person, Thornton being, you know, the professional killer or whatever, and those others come to town. Season 2, it's Dunst and Jesse Clemens' character. Whatever. Season 3, it's, you know, the Ewan McGregor brothers, whatever. But also at the same time, each season, you can say one of your, if not your main character, depending how you want to interpret it, you know, your main protagonist is a member of the police. Right? Because you got her in the first season. Along with Alison Tolman's character and Colin Hanks as well, I guess, to a certain degree. Second season, of course, is Patrick Wilson and Ted Danson to a certain degree. Third season, it's, what's her name from The Leftovers?
Carrie Coon.
So there's your main person of authority there and all the idiots at the police force there. So far, we've got 2 episodes here and I cannot count the guy who works on behalf of the Fadas.
Maybe it's Oliphant.
So maybe it's Oliphant. I just didn't think he was playing that significant a part in this season. So maybe I misunderstood that, or maybe they just. I mean, they're obviously already changing the dynamic of the show by making it, you know, this kind of mob showdown kind of thing, while also dealing with issues of you know, immigrants and race at that time. So it's I think it's a very ambitious thing that Noah Hawley is trying to do, because I don't, you know, and whether it's going to work or not, I guess remains to be seen. I really like these 2 episodes so far, but to me also a lot of it does feel very introductory. It feels like, okay, I get the inciting thing, whatever. I don't want to say something as silly as this, especially because I hate when other people say this. But right now I'm going, not sure who I'm rooting for. I mean, I kind of like the Chris Rock character, so I figure, okay, is he kind of the guys we're supposed to care more about and be following them? You know, I mean, they're still crooks, but I guess, you know, everything they've done and said so far, they seem to be crooks with honor. And maybe they're also trying to legitimize, but, you know, which hence the credit card idea and stuff. So I guess, but I don't know. It's just, it's maybe it's such a broad palette they're working with here. It's a little, it's harder for me to focus so far, but I'm still enjoying it. I am aware of some of the reviews the show has gotten. And I'm not going to say generally it's gotten, from what I know, it's not gotten bad reviews, but it's not gotten outstanding reviews either. But I also remember all the reviews I heard about when Perry Mason came out. And I'm pretty certain both you and I really like Perry Mason more than those reviews would have suggested.
Absolutely. So I mean, I understand what you're saying, and the way I felt about it was more conventional than I'm used to from Fargo,
right?
Because it's set in a world that we're very familiar with. But there are the characters with their affectations and the quirks that, that Fargo's known for. What I think this does have different is the young girl in the middle of this, who's sort of not a participant,
right.
Who's sort of an observer. That's something different that the other seasons haven't had, where you sort of have a main character slash possible narrator. We don't know. I mean, she narrated a large portion of the first episode. They may completely drop that, or they may bring it back, but that's different, that we have sort of an outsider watching things in the middle of this, and then we'll find out what happens with her. But I did want, as we're getting close, I think, to wrapping up, I did want to point out a couple of things that I thought were interesting that jumped out to me. And one was the theme that repeated throughout the first section. Mm-hmm. Was a song by Duke Ellington. And interestingly enough, the name of the song is Caravan. so you talk about the immigrant experience. And it was really cool the way it was done in different styles of music, ending with the really cool jazz sound. You know, finally, when we meet Loy in Canon Unlimited, I thought that was great. And I particularly enjoyed Dr. Senator. I like him so much that I think he's going to die. You know, he's
that actor always plays guys who die.
Yeah.
He never makes it to the end. He always dies.
He seems like the consigliere that everybody needs and that can possibly lead you astray when you lose. And he's a cool customer. Really enjoyed him, but I particularly liked his line that you all haven't been here as long as us. Yeah. You just got off the boat, but we're like the earth in the dirt. And I thought that was an interesting take in a sort of a comment that
the wind, you know, people, I think it was the wind in the dirt, which I really,
yeah, the wind in the dirt. And you know, it's an interesting comment to think that people who arrived after Black people have in many ways achieved greater social acceptance now, maybe not then, but now, than Black people have now. And I thought that was a particularly nice line, well-written line. And I really like that character. So I'm, I mean, like you, I mean, it's not the Fargo I know per se, but I was encouraged. I really liked it. I want to see where it goes. I'm particularly interested how it all ties together. And sometimes, you know, the one thing we've seen about Noah Hawley's work is it, if anything, it's always ambitious.
Yes.
And sometimes he pulls it off and sometimes he doesn't, but he'll always swing for the fences. And I think that's something you and I both appreciate about him.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't care. I don't care if it's something like this or it's a giant pig with, you know, with nipples. Anyway, that Legion thing. So,
the totally creepy cult house.
Yeah, we still haven't gotten past that. Yeah, I mean, again, totally true. And yes, this isn't the quote unquote Fargo that I'm accustomed to. But then again, you know, each season is its own unique beast anyway. I mean, one might find a certain synchronicity between the first two seasons because you had a more direct connection, you know, family-wise, whatever, even though they took place, you know, a few decades apart, and one had UFOs. And the third season, at least on this podcast, we had our issues with. I mean, I have a lot of issues with the third season. There's a lot I love about the third season. There's a lot I was kind of, And I remember thinking while I was watching these first 2 hours, the thing you're referring to as far as the girl doing the initial narration and talking, and I think she does a little bit more narration at another point in it as well. I might be... Yeah, doesn't she? I remember thinking, oh, maybe they're trying to learn the lesson of how the John Hamm thing didn't quite work so well in season three because it... Or is this, that was Fargo, not Legion, right? Because that was the problem. I kept getting them to... That was Fargo. Yeah, it was Fargo. Okay. Whew. Trying to remember. Am I talking about Legion or Fargo with that thing? But here it's like, no, make it a character that's actually in the show. And yes, she can be an observer as well as a participant to a certain degree. So, and having it be, you know, a 16-year-old girl of color just makes it something, oh, that's different. You know, a lot of times you get these things, it's usually like the, you know, the 12-year-old boy and you know, dad's a gangster or it's a Bronx Tale and dad's a bus driver and someone else is the gangster. And, you know, that whole kind of good, early Goodfellas kind of vibe kind of a thing.
Right.
So I like that they're going to go this route with it. So, and I don't really know much else about the season, so I'm kind of curious. And also what's fascinating, it's an 11-episode season, and from what I understand with the reviews, pretty much any and all reviews that were done on the show were based on 9 episodes. So none of these critics have seen the final 2 episodes because they're filming them and shit. So I'm very curious. I'm just like, ooh, that's intriguing to me because no one's gotten to see how this thing's going to end. I'm very excited about that.
So, and I think, weren't the prior seasons 10?
I don't have it in front of me, but if I'm not mistaken, I think they fluctuate from season to season. I think each season's been different, if I'm not mistaken.
I could be wrong, and I will check before we podcast next week. But
I'm looking right now, so don't worry.
I think both season 1 and 2 were 10 episodes. I think this is, which if this is an 11-episode season, that's a blessing to occur based on what's going on in our world and production. I mean, we're pretty lucky to get 11 episodes anyway. You know, based on what's going on in the world.
The answer is you're correct.
Okay, I thought so. I did not, as the intelligence community would say, have a high degree of confidence in my information.
My confusion was, again, it's a Noah Hawley thing. Legion was a show that had 3 seasons, and I believe each season had a different number of episodes.
I think that's right.
I think one was like 9 episodes, one was 11, and one was lower again, like 8 or something like that. I can't remember the number. It was something goofy like that. It's like, all right. But yeah, you're right. The first 3 were all 10, and they actually gave him an 11th for this one. And considering how long these 2 were, you know, I'm going to assume we're going to get some much longer ones. Oh, I just spoiled something for myself. Great. Oh. I know that character will still be alive by that time. Great. Anyway, it's not smart to know that someone's not dead, I guess. And yeah, and plus, as I've said a million times before, when you get into things that take place in the 30s, 40s, and you know, what the heck, even the early 50s, I'm a sucker for that time periods. If you do mob stuff well, I'm into it. It just has to be done well. And plus, it's Noah Hawley. I'm going to be there for it anyway. I'm going to give him as much slack as possible because I think he's earned it for all the reasons you've already said. I mean, he can spin some great dialogue. He always has great ambitions. Sometimes his ambitions may exceed what he's able to pull off, but at least it's always worth checking out. You know, even if something turns out to be what I always call like a magnificent failure, you know, but at least it's something worth checking out. So, and I'm sure I'm going to feel at least that way about this. So far, I'm in. I like these two episodes. There's still so much more to unpack. I know it's going to happen over the next few episodes because there's still characters we still need to be introduced to. I mean, just seeing Timothy the Elephant, but we haven't technically been introduced to him yet. Unfortunately, I already know his character's name, which is ridiculous. I've met all those other names. His name is Dick Deafy, Deafy. That's in, you know, it's like his nickname. Wickware. So take out the Deafy. So he's Dick Wickware.
Wow.
What? What?
It's just that's insane.
Oh my god. Gotta love him.
It's insane.
Gotta love him. Alrighty then. So yeah, we will be the hope is that we will be recording these every Sunday night. Obviously, there may be, if there's ever a time that, you know, say Brian is not unavailable, we'll try to delay it if necessary. Dan may or may not step in. It depends on his own schedule, because sometimes he works late on Sunday, so doesn't really work schedule wise for him to get home, then watch it, then, you know. But we'll see. I wouldn't rule it out. You know, it's been a while to have Dan here, so it would be nice. And that's about it. I had mentioned on the previous podcast, for those who watch The Boys, and you probably heard it already, I had discussed an upcoming podcast project, which is the greatest TV drama episodes of all time project. I'll just mention it, and I'm going to give myself 30 seconds, no more here. That's a project that's going to start sometime in late October. Each of 20 podcasts, so they'll be done from that point through next year. Each one will center on a different episode of one of 20 shows. I'm going to put this all together by going through various articles and lists that have been done over the years, as well as websites that do this kind of stuff, and come up with a list. No show that we've already covered episode-wise will be on the list, so therefore there will be no Better Call Saul episode in it. Sorry, Better Call Saul. And a few other things that we've done over the years. Like, I can't have an episode of Fargo 2 in there. Fargo Season 1? But could be. Might be in there. Who knows? And no show gets to be in there more than once. So only one Sopranos episode, or only one Breaking Bad episode. Can't have two, can't have three, can only be one. So that means there will be 20 different series. Obviously, there will be a few that Dan will absolutely co-host with me, because it would be weird if BSG, for example, is one of the 20. I kind of have to have Dan. It would be wrong. It would be criminal. Or Twin Peaks. It would be criminal. But like the aforementioned Sopranos, Dan's never seen the Sopranos. I'm going to have to recruit someone else to watch that one. And lastly, I will announce on our Facebook page a week in advance what the next episode is that's going to be covered, so folks can watch that episode on their own and then enjoy listening to the podcast. So either it's a random episode of Mad Men or Lost or Game of Thrones or whatever the heck shows are going to be on that list. As I mentioned, if you're trying to figure out what the 20 shows are going to be, look at that picture. It's our cover photo on our Facebook page. 18 of the 20 shows can be found in that picture. And the two that aren't both feature the same actor. So that's my little trivia question that will be ongoing for the next month or so. And Brian, I'm sure I'm going to get you to at least do a couple of them. So we'll see.
I look forward to it. That'd be awesome.
All right. So we did that pretty quickly. All right, cool. So if you enjoyed this podcast, and I know we enjoyed recording it, then you will probably enjoy hanging out on the podcast page as well. That's the Serious TV Drama podcast page. Like the page, and you can join the conversation about shows like Fargo, like all those ones I just mentioned. There are so many things to talk about. You can also find us in Apple Podcasts. That's where you can subscribe to us and rate and review us there. It's what I used to call iTunes, but apparently no one calls it that anymore. Whatever, I'm old. you can find all 270, this will be number 271 of our podcasts if you go to stvdpodcast.podbean, just how you think it would be spelled, .com, and that's where, like I just said, 271 of our podcasts can be found. Some of them are labeled forbidden and you can't listen to them. But you know what? If you click on it a couple times, it might work anyway. I don't know why it happened. I don't know. And finally, you can follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast. That's STVD as in Serious TV Drama. So Brian and I believe, you know, knock on wood. Wow. Jeez. Knock on a vault. we'll be back next week to cover the next episode of Fargo. And for folks who are watching The Boys, Jamie and I will be recording the next Boys podcast tomorrow night. So basically the plan is for the next few weeks, you'll get the Fargo podcasts in your, you know, you'll find them available Monday morning, and therefore you should find your Boys podcast available Tuesday morning, and then you have the rest of the week to listen or ignore them. So there you go. Alrighty then. Brian, thank you so much for staying up late. I know you've got to work early in the morning, so I appreciate you managing and also bringing the goods as you always do when you do the podcast.
Well, it was my pleasure to be here. I enjoyed it.
All right. With that, I will say good night to everybody out there and good night, Brian. And as always, I will pretend to give my co-host the last word.
Good night, everyone, and good luck to your Yankees and good luck to my Cincinnati Reds in the baseball playoffs.
Oh, yeah, anything like that. I didn't even mention baseball. Stupid game today. Anyway, yeah, good night, everybody.